Hello and welcome to this week's edition of the Real Cyber Talk podcast. Today we're joined by a distinguished guest, Mike Koss. Do you want to give us a bit of an intro, mate, into who you are?
Yeah, sure. So I'm Mike Koss. I've been in the security industry for about 28 years now, and I'm currently heading up, currently CISO at RTGS Global.
Fantastic. So we like to keep these things quite informal. I'm sure you've got absolutely no problem with that. So where should we start? Where did you want to go first, Mike?
I guess for me, I want to sort of start with current challenges and problems I'm facing, right?
Yeah, let's go with it.
It's a standard one, isn't it? So I guess what we're doing at RTGS is we're building out a global settlement fabric, trying to become an FMI, financial sort of fintech startup, right? So it's always challenging. And at the moment, I think what I will say is that in the last 2 and a bit years that I've been at RTGS, we've managed to effectively be very successful in building a very secure, very sort of modern, fast areas of detection across a very complex network with a team of two.
No.
So what I would like to do just before, and I did promise my security engineer I would give them props for actually doing all the hard work for the last year, whereas I've written PowerPoints. But I guess for us, like, the biggest challenge we've got, and I just think everyone has currently at the moment, is just looking at the sector, looking at the level of investment, the amount of tooling that's coming about, sort of your sort of shift from your legacy MS or your managed service providers, right? And seeing a shift more into a modern detection, right? Because we are entirely Azure-based, right? And we're entirely remote. So we literally have, I think it's like 10 desks in London, but everyone else works from home. We've got like 50, 60 odd people, right? So your old business model, your business model of like your actual firewalls within a comms room with a bunch of switches. And I'm sure this is common for a lot of people now since the pandemic. We're now moving away into this sort of hybrid or purely remote working thing. And how do you secure what is effectively an FMI with people operating and working from home? And then one of the other things we're looking at now is, well, we don't have that legacy tech. We don't have those, you know, physical servers anywhere anymore. We don't have the data centers. Everything is Azure-based. We're losing a lot of software as a service, a lot of applications as a service, and the core service that we operate itself is using like AKS and a few other bits and pieces and sort of pulling everything together across a geographically dispersed network.
Yeah.
Right? So how do you operate all that with a team of two in an ever-changing attack landscape, with also the fact from time to discovery of exploits to weaponization being ridiculously small.
Mm-hmm.
I think the Chinese at the moment are turning it around in like 36 hours or something like that. Mm-hmm. Probably somebody fact check that. But it's a very short lead time. You know, back gone are the days that you'd end up fuzzing something, have a poke around at it for a couple of weeks, and then go, oh, I think I've got a proof of concept. Now it's effectively like, here's the CVS. Oh, here's the exploit. It's now being attacked in the wild, right? So how are we going from the old ways of working whereby you had a lead time, you had a little bit of grace period to take a vulnerability, get yourselves together, put mitigations while the patch came out, to literally having no time. And that's huge, and I'm pretty sure that will lead quite nicely to what you guys are doing. But it's like, how do we end up getting to a point whereby we feel comfortable with the sort of the response time from a vulnerability being disclosed to being weaponized to end up not impacting us? So I think, you know, that's some of the challenges that I'm facing currently. Other stuff is because RTGS is trying to be a global company. We have to deal with the ever-changing geopolitical landscape, which, as you may have noticed, the last couple of years has been somewhat interesting, right? We've gone from a state of relatively, we knew who, you know, where the threat actors were, to now having this sort of thawing of politics in the Near East that's sort of been stagnant for the last 30 years since the fall of the Soviet Union. And now we're starting to see different things sort of changing, and we're seeing very diverse and polarized opinions within those regions, which are then also like, you know, there's a pro EU lean towards Western, there's a pro lean towards the East. How does that work, and how does that change the threat landscape? So, you know, that's constantly on my radar. And then looking at the industry that we have and the intelligence, threat intelligence that we have coming out there, a lot of it is enrichment around SOC and SIEM, and other stuff is like, yeah. What I'm finding in that area is that the custom level reports I think people need after the pandemic just are there, but they're custom reports, right? And they're 10 grand per pop. And if you need to do that across the world, that it doesn't scale, right? The cost is insane. The amount of time, turnaround time is so vast. It could be a week or two. And in a geopolitical landscape, within all these conflicts and tensions, that stuff changes on a daily basis. So I'm finding that as a bit of a struggle. And then finally, like the age old, how does security and engineering with two conflicting priorities, how do you work together to build something that is both secure but also agile enough to meet your business developments? And in a startup environment, whereby as we were talking previous to this, like, how do you end up pivoting but not pivot too far? And how do you pivot quick enough, but also still, for me, keep secure? So there's just a brain dump of what my current concerns are.
100%. Sounds great. So a lot to unpack there. Let's go right back to the start. You spoke about the different, almost like building a remote first company and the security implications. Now, all of the, you were doing this pre-COVID, during COVID, and I know you worked for businesses that were going through a digital transformation program. So you've got that experience of shifting from the legacy tech to the to the new ways, and having to probably keep a lot of the legacy tech anyway.
Correct.
All of those businesses will look at the likes of where you are now and say, well, they've got it easy because they don't have the legacy tech. You see the words coming from the big banks over to the neobanks and say, well, we can't do what they can do.
True.
But, is it all sunshine and roses, or are there other challenges that you then have to compete with? I suppose resources being a big one.
I mean, resources is always going to be a challenge in the cyberspace. For some reason, cybersecurity always tends to be about 2% of the IT tech budget and also headcount, which is crazy considering what's at stake, right? And I don't see that changing anytime soon, which is fine. just to go back to your point, I mean, who doesn't love having an AS400 mainframe stuck in a comms room that's not being touched, or a database that you've had for since the 1970s? Those are always fun challenges. But you know what the easiest part of those is being able to go, actually, that is a massive risk. Let's stick that on the risk register. Let's figure out a way of mitigating it. Let's put in additional checks and boundaries for how those things are accessed. Let's actually tighten screws on those access controls, all those bits and pieces. Nowadays, you're working with emerging technologies, right? You're looking at the Azure stack. Do you know how frequently that changes? Like this morning, my security engineer was like, I messaged Microsoft about this one thing I needed to do. They pointed me to the documentation. The documentation lists a value that when you put it into PowerShell is not a valid value. But then also, as I'm sure you're aware, building a startup, right? You'll have one idea and you'll have one path or course of direction that you think, this is it. This is brilliant. We've got it. And then 2 months later, something will be released or a new feature or something like that in preview. And you're like, actually, do you know what? We could improve on this. We could modernize. We could do all this stuff. And also, they also depreciate functions and features quite quickly. So how the hell, with a team of two and an engineering team that are forced to build at pace, do you ensure that you are, A, not building legacy? And when I say legacy, I mean months old, not decades. But that's still a concern, right? So you can end up using a function or a feature that gets depreciated within 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And you're like, okay, cool. Well, now we need to rework that. Or, we started off using one bit of technology, pivoted to something else. We had an entire business model that was pushing out network connectors and gateways into people's environment. It was an SDK that you had to download, we could build the marketplace, blah, blah, blah. And now we're like, we just have a gateway and they can go via an API gateway. So we've entirely pivoted. So, change.
And this makes me think back, and this is testament to the era that we're in at the moment. When I was a kid, computers back then, you bought a computer, and me being a kid, I'm 28 now, so we're talking maybe
maybe
15 years ago, maybe when you were, I'm not going to go there. I am far enough away from you to not get hit, I think. You bought a computer in those days, and 2 years later, the technology had advanced so much that computer was what you'd now consider legacy tech. We're not in that era anymore. No. I've got an iPhone that's 4 years old, and it is just about as good as the latest one that came out because of the fact that a lot of situations. But what I will say is, look at what's happened over the last 12 months with LLMs. You could have been architecting and building a solution to do lots of stuff, maybe with a decision tree style system. Yeah, that's taken you a long time. Then technology like LLMs comes out, and you realize that your competitors are now able to do it twice as fast as you, in twice as better way, because they've taken us already. I guess we're still in that era, right, where you could make big decisions that are considered legacy.
Well, they did, didn't they? So a number of companies started to build their own LLMs, and then OpenAI went, "Hey, here's our marketplace,
yeah.
right?" And everyone just went, "Oh, well, there's my startup gone." Like, and then that happened within a week, and it was kind of out of nowhere as well.
Yeah.
And it's just been CES, hasn't it? So a lot of the stuff that's come out, boring tech, like transparent TVs, but somebody's created a handheld the rabbit device.
Yeah.
You've seen this. This is absolutely either terrifying or brilliant. And it's, the price point is like $200, right? And you can just basically like, oh yeah, go and book my hotel, my accommodation, my flights. And whereas LLMs will give you the itinerary, they can't do the next step, which is book it. Mm. Now, this sounds great unless you're drunk.
Yeah, yeah.
Because I was chatting to the security engineer, she's like, do you know what? I'll end up booking a trip to Mexico when I'm hammered. And I'm like, well, probably. But, you know, we've gone from, and this is it, it's a 12-month cycle. We've gone from, oh, here's a chatbot that you can ask some questions to, and it's all kind of cool, or here's some generative AI. And have you seen the difference between Midjourney version 1 to Midjourney version 6 or Alpha?
It's crazy.
It's like, what the hell?
Mm.
There's obviously, one of the things we're now seeing, just to pivot a little bit, one of the big things we're now seeing is, people are coming to me or coming to other people and asking, well, let's get the data.
Yeah.
That's the next thing. It's the data. It's like, you know, like data scraping was a big thing or data mining was a big thing, right? Now it's huge.
Yeah.
How do we get the data? How do we get the underlying data to train our LLMs or train our new AI models to allow us to have a unique product? Mm. And that in itself is going to be a career path,
yeah.
which is crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm just firing up Python again, right? So
100%.
But yeah, as you say, like the change, the rapid pace of change now is it has accelerated massively. And one of the things that I think, original talking about, you said, like, how do you keep up to date, right?
Yeah.
I don't sleep. It's impossible. And I've been doing this for like so long. And the difficulty you've got as well in trying to keep pace with everything that's going on is unless you are actually dedicating, and it's not easy to dedicate like an hour or two to just digesting stuff. And there's always, you see all these adverts on YouTube and all this stuff, like, oh, here's my free newsletter, right? You get a newsletter and it'll tell you the headlines and the surface deal. But if you're in security, it's not enough.
Mm.
Like, it's because, okay, cool. Well, what's the impact of this? And you dig into it further and further and further. I guess I'm in a fortunate position because I've been in the industry so long. A lot of people talk to me about a lot of other things, just like off the record, random stuff. I always know what's going on because what's impacting other people, they come back to me for sanity checks or for advice. So that also helps. Like having a good network where it's collaborative and chat and doing stuff like this is really useful as well because I'm sure off the back of that, somebody else will ping me and likewise to yourself, right? But there was a good 2 to 3 years period whereby I just noped out of the scene, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was just like, you know what, this COVID thing's a bit of a, it changed the social dynamics. And then I think I started doing talks and speaking again last year and I started to get myself back into it. But prior to that, we had a very solid Manchester and London scene, right? Whereby we met up frequently.
Mm.
Granted, most of the time it was messy, but you were having those conversations, and I think everyone knew everyone. And now I do feel like there is a little bit of a fragmentation now. We need to sort of maybe pull that back, maybe we don't, I don't know. But like staying up to date is a very, very tricky situation. And then because we have, or we're just, you know, our RTS itself has got like a Chinese, or not Chinese, a Hong Kong / Asia presence, right? To keep up with that as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And then look at how,
I was going to say that obviously you being a global company, it's been my general experience that the UK is leaps and bounds behind where a lot of other countries are in terms of their approach to cybersecurity tooling, approach to problem solving and solutions. And I don't know if that's been your experience, but to me, part of it comes back to what you were talking about with the geopolitical landscape, the idea that, you know, some of these countries, I won't name names, but some of the countries that are under incredible geopolitical pressure have, as a result of that, been forced to mature way beyond what maybe we've been required to mature at. I don't know if you see that.
This has been a rant that I've had for many, many years because, you know, I've traveled to the Black Hat US. In fact, I don't go to the UK one because I'm like, well, go to the US, right, and get it from the source.
Yeah.
And you go there and 90% of the time I'll just be at a bar chatting to the other security guys and I'm like, all right, what are you seeing? What are you guys doing?
Yep.
And I'm like, yeah, okay, cool. Nobody else is doing that in the UK.
Yeah.
Right? And they're not. And there is a lot of stagnation. And I don't want to throw shade, but I will. Like, people just do what's prescribed by Gartner.
Mm-hmm.
Or people will do, and I always have this, I'm a firm believer in a CISO who's highly technical. It's my, because I am, right?
I
do like to promote myself in that sense. But most CISOs aren't.
No.
Most CISOs are business guys, and they need to be, because they have to talk to boards, and they need to be able to translate financial ROI insecurity, which is like, well, we did get breached.
Yeah.
Right. But you have to be able to negotiate that correctly. And a lot of these CISOs who have maybe got an interest in it or used to be CTOs have then been approached because they're under regulation or they need to have a CISO. And these guys are not, they're not coming with the attacker's mindset, right? Mm-hmm. They're not thinking about it from a pen testing point. They haven't been in the trenches. And I'm not saying that's a bad thing, because every company operates in a different model. Like, I am definitely not a CISO for some organizations. Yeah. They just wouldn't tolerate my level of belligerence. But there has to be that political, not political, but it's like the, it's almost like a, I'll relate back to hacker terms. They need to be good social engineers, right? They need to be able to talk the talk and do the business stuff. And the problem that you've got there is that they were only ever going to push it within the boundaries that they can justifiably back up if it's supported by industry trends. And those industry trends are led by Times of Gartner or Forrester or all those companies. So unless you are, it goes back to keeping up to date, right? And you're right, the UK is far behind. And from a geopolitical sense, ever since the first big attack, NotPetya, right? You look at that, and then the escalation in the sort of defense that needs to go on around the sort of power grids and all those sort of things, that did sort of push things forward. But it's the attack and defender mentality, right? As an industry, we're still losing. There's no way. There's nobody who can say that. We're doing great as a cybersecurity sector. Every day it's like ransomware, data leak, massive data leak. And the problem we've got is because it's happened so often, we've reached a point of desensitization.
Yeah.
23andMe just got totally owned.
Yeah.
Which is, and the way that they did it was beautiful as well. It's like credential stuffing. And then another feature that allowed for a massive amount of data mining. That's your entire ancestry stuff, your family connections. That's then gets sold on the dark web. That then becomes identity theft. That then, and we're so used to it that, I don't even know what they've done because I'm keeping abreast of it. I just saw the technical piece. No doubt they'll be like, here, you can have fraud protection for 3 months.
Yeah.
And since the pandemic as well, I've been reading loads of books. And there's a really good book about the US's response and how the fraud was taken, how fraud was occurred within all of the relief funds. And one of the top pieces of information was we need to strengthen our controls, right? Because they weren't in place. And this goes for everyone across everywhere. We need to strengthen our controls around identity.
Mm-hmm.
And the other part is we need to tackle disinformation. And bizarrely, last year, I was approached by 2 to 3 different organizations to help or advise on, one, how do we create a global identity that allows us to stand behind information that we put out there, and you are who you say you are. And then the other one is around sort of like, just sort of moving away from having to do these, you hold up the stupid cards for your fintech, right? Where it's like, my name is blah, and here's a photo. Right. That stuff is dead now because you've got generative AI, which you can create a puppet identity quite easily using any of the information that you've managed to acquire off one of these breaches.
Yeah.
And then you can stuff that into generative AI, and you can even now get it to hold up a card with the date and time, right? So people are reaching out to me to try and combat those sort of things.
And is that the, all this talk, you don't have to look far to find threats of large language models, threats of emerging generative AI technology. And everyone, usually it's something to the effect of prompt engineering or prompt injection, or trying to get the LLM to either do something they're not supposed to do or dump training data.
Yep.
And these are all the things people are talking about. What you're talking about here is very, very different in terms of being able to, fraudulently pretend to be someone else at scale.
And this is the point. People are looking at it, and rightly so, right? They're looking at it going, okay, well, what's the safeguards? What are the technical controls are in place on an LLM to prevent it being compromised? Right, cool. But then what's the wider stuff? And then you always see the standard one that comes out. Oh, well, LLMs will allow better crafted phishing emails.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, why is phishing still one of the top threats?
Yeah.
Although, actually, I know why. When I started at RTGS, we ran a simulated phishing campaign. 30% of people fell for it. That was 2 years ago. The latest one person fell for it. And she phoned me up and was like, oh my God, I clicked it by mistake. No, you didn't. I won't name her, but she's the only person in the shade was thrown. So, LLMs, LLMs, large language models, they'll be used for good, they'll be used for bad. What I think is quite interesting as well, if you're looking at the, we're talking about training data.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff we're looking at is, oh, dystopia, right? We're going to have AI, it's going to go AGI, we're all doomed, blah, blah, blah. But when X created their one, and they used all their training data, and they were it was meant to be like, you know, a little bit more right-leaning.
Yeah.
It's not. It's actually massively left-leaning, because if you look at it from the general bulk of data that it's trained on, which is X, which, as we know, is not exactly the most left-leaning, it still came out massively left-leaning. Yeah,
one of the first things that it did was start talking about how awful it thought Musk was.
Yeah, right? Mm. So you've got to a point whereby, if you're looking at what we're training on, which is what we as a species are saying, actually, it's you're blocking highs and criticals, right? And you're saying, look, we're not going to let those two. Absolutely, we don't have the tolerance for it. Sometimes a high will sneak its way through because you've got all these cycles that has to be done, and you'll put some mitigation in place. But one problem is you've got your lows and your mediums that are continually being kicked down the road, right? So maybe you have like six lows, three mediums, and then the next release is another three and another six. You're aware that, you know, if you a low can then lead to a medium, and a medium coupled with another medium, coupled with another medium, can lead to an exploit, or at least a breach to a certain extent, right? Mm-hmm. And it blows my mind that people are just, and I know it's time, and I know it's cost, and I know it's everyone's talking about shifting left and shifting left. That's great, but if you're still letting through lows and mediums, obviously straight away, I have to let through lows and mediums.
You're never going to get that context at SAST, are you? Never going to get that stitching together, because when you test something in the code, it has no idea what that static scanner could be checking that code. It doesn't know if that's a running in an OT environment, running in a piece of software, it doesn't care.
But then you've got the same problem across everything, right?
Yeah.
Because even when you do a pen test, when is the last time that anyone has done a pen test engagement, apart from like a CBEST, right? Where they've gone, you know what, crack on. So we want you to test this bit, but don't go outside of this bit, and definitely don't look at that bit. Yeah. And it's like, well, hang on.
Yeah.
I never run around a hacker that's gone, oh, I'm sorry, that system's not in scope. Yeah, I'm just not going to poke that.
Yeah.
It's ridiculous.
If this was real life, I'd be fishing Debbie at marketing straight away, and that'd be obviously the route that I would take.
But even, you know, and this is something I, because I'm nasty like this, it's something I used to do with the consultants back at, back in the pen testing days. Even if you do bring somebody in and tell them to have at it, unless that person actually knows what matters to your business and what's relevant to you, and unless that person understands things as deeply as you do, or as deeply as an attacker who's got specific motivations at a specific time does, then saying have at it doesn't actually accomplish the goal of having at it.
And to extrapolate on that, how many pen testers do you know that are specialists across all forms of vulnerabilities, right? And if you go out to a pen testing company and say, hey, listen, they'll scope it.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time, they're going to get scoped for a web app pen test or an infrastructure review.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. What you're not going out to them and saying is you're focusing on, you are effectively projecting what you want tested, right? And a lot, unless you, honest to God, know every single component of your organization. And remember, the person who's scoping this is either a security engineer or a CISO, right? Or head of, right? Do they know everything about their system? Do they know every single component? How honest are the engineers and developers about what's going through? This is why you need to have these four sort of checkpoints and gates, because I try. And like I said, but here's your point, right? I need to keep up to date. I need to understand every component of my organization with a team of two. And one of them gets very cranky, and it's not me. And then you've also got an engineering team who are under pressure to deliver against business outcomes and propositions in a startup, which will pivot because there's a new thing, right? And it always becomes an impossible situation. But giving a it's visibility, right? That's the core thing. And if you're able to have that visibility, which we just still in the UK aren't great with, I mean, I've been poking around, doing some Google hacking, and you come across like open directory shares, still to this day within web servers, whereby somebody may have uploaded a document with the entire username and passwords for all of their company because they're going on Christmas break, right? And they don't want to have to go through email or something like that. You stumble across that, and you've just exploited their entire organization through an open directory share.
Mm-hmm.
That's a massive vulnerability, but an open directory share? What's that, Legion?
Yeah.
Maybe. Like if you look at most of the way the websites are put together, you've got like slash images and then that images directory. or other places whereby they've got a web form, right? How are they protecting that web data if it's not in this database? They're probably dumping that into a TXT file in the same directory as where that form is.
Mm-hmm.
And if they haven't secured that, you've just got everyone who submitted a query, you've got all their PII data.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a GDPR breach.
Mm-hmm.
But how do you class that?
Yeah.
You've got a web form in an open directory, but unless the context is known, back to your point, they'll just look at it and go, okay, cool, you've got open directory, that's a medium. But in fact, straight away, that's a critical, because you've now got all the PII data. And if the pen tester doesn't go in and open every single file within that directory to see if there's anything in there, or download it and do some sort of horrible regex to try and find that sort of information.
All of that information exists, and the irony is that all of it exists. You know, this isn't even necessarily a people thing, because all that information exists within different tools. Like you know, you've got an asset management tool which contains a bunch of context. You've got a SaaS tool which is finding vulnerabilities in code. One of the things that we often say is when you're actually fixing something, for example, and it's been found at static and then released as a medium, then it was found in DAS and then it was found in a pen test. Like, all of these different mechanisms finding things provide a different type of context. Right. Not even different levels, but different types.
Mm-hmm.
Like, if I was to share with you a DAST result of a SQL injection and a SAST result, what do you then have? Well, you have all the context of DAST in terms of where it is in production, its exploitability and everything, but you also know exactly where it is in the code from the SAST result. So when we start combining these things together at scale, there are benefits for the engineers, there are benefits for security teams to see data more objectively about the risks and everything like that. You know, and so often we're bringing in these technologies and we're using them as isolated technologies. You know, it's difficult, right?
But then you've got to understand, and I think that goes back to my previous point, right? If you're a business guy who's brought in to do a business thing, you're ticking the box required for each tool. I must have AV.
Yeah.
I must have, you know, DAS and SAS. I mean, God, I don't know if everyone does, right? Let's be honest, right?
No, definitely.
You've got to have, I think people still think they need to have AV, firewall, you know. I'll tell you what I really, really would like everyone to fix, which would be amazing. On top of all the vulnerability measure, access control, can we just sort that out, right?
Yeah, that'd be great.
I, honest to God, still have to argue about why you have to have separation of duties, why you have to use a privileged account versus your standard login to your desktop. Like, come on, it's 2024.
Yeah.
Can we just, like, seriously, just everyone sit down and go, oh yeah, I know you guys are right.
Yeah.
Access control is still MFA. Was it the SEC just got done? Some Bitcoin stuff saying, hey, we've approved it.
Yeah.
Reason why they got done? Weak password, no MFA.
Yeah.
Come on.
Literally, this, you know, 23andMe wasn't too dissimilar either, was it?
No, it was credential stuffing, right? So no MFA, credential stuffing.
Yeah.
But come on, access control. I know it's boring. Mm-hmm. Let's be honest, it is goddamn boring.
Yeah.
We all want to talk about the sexy kit. We all want to look about the large language models. We all want to talk about new AI bots that are going to help you and are going to talk to you and augment your team.
Mm-hmm.
Just sort of access control, please.
You know, it goes back to the same thing that you know, these things are easy to do, but the only defense I have of this is that doing easy things all the time, every time, can be hard, right?
Yes.
You know, like. You know, turn on, make sure people can do 2FA. But then when you're building and deploying and you've got all these different systems, like, you know, these are the things, right? But we need to get the fundamentals right on time, every time. And that is the tricky
part. And the worst part is it's boring as hell.
Yeah.
And security guys, you know, the guys who spend all their time in the trenches, you know, it's just a frustration. They'll just sit there and be like, oh, well, we're not going to do it anyway.
Mm-hmm.
And the worst part is they're right.
Yeah.
But I see as a vendor that being our responsibility more than anybody else's responsibility. Yeah, these things are boring and people aren't implementing them. But that's just because we've not given the right tools for them to be able to do it in a way that makes it a painless, straightforward, easy, consistent process. You know, I see a lot of people coming out against the whole 23andMe problem, a lot of vendors saying the response to that whole thing they dislike, and the fact that they didn't have multi-factor authentication is just ridiculous. And it's like, but so neither do 80% of companies, because it is a barrier to entry for new users, and it is hard to get the uptick. And if people are having to make those kinds of trade-offs, and in the 30 years since we first invented MFA, we've not come up with a way to make that a nice, easy, painless process. That is a failure of the entire industry.
But also, you can't. I work for a wealth management company whose client base was 60 upwards.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Go and use MFA.
Yeah.
What? They still, to the point that one of the solutions we had to design had to have a landline phone number to phone and verify because that was what they were used to.
Yeah.
And the point is that, yeah, it's fine to get your high horse and say, and when I say fixed access control, I mean the separation of privacy and all those sort of things and pushing things in the right context. The way that, you know, there are technologies that sit that could have worked for anti-credential stuff and detection and like that. There was a new company called Shape, I think they got bought by F5. And they did that whole credential stuffing detection and mitigation and blocking, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We used it quite heavily.
One time stuff.
It was, you know, it was like a, you know, it's like a CDN type solution that come in, you do all your analysis and then block all that sort of stuff. It wasn't cheap.
Yeah, yeah.
And if it's not, and yeah, again, I don't think it's listed under any boilerplate, here's your best practice for security. You must have an anti-credential stuffing solution in front. We probably may get there, but we're not there now.
Yeah.
So yeah.
Perfect. Right. Well, I won't take up any more of your time. You've been an absolute legend today. Thank you so much. I hope we got through a lot there for our audience. And thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the Real Cyber Talk podcast. And we'll see you next week. Bye now.